We began talking about the origin of inflation, and today we will continue discussing the origin and the end of inflation. So let's ask again, how could an initial period of strong inflation have started? What could have been the origin of it? And as we discussed last time, all it takes for inflation to take off is that somewhere in a pre-existing universe, that somewhere the potential of a scalar field happened to fluctuate to be really large. Not necessarily in a large region, but in amplitude it has to be large. And the region in which it is large just needs to be a few, let's say, Planck lengths across at least. Just large enough so that we can make sense of the statement that the potential is large compared to the derivatives of the field. So you see, if the patch is a few Planck lengths across, we can calculate derivatives, spatial and spatial derivatives, and decide whether or not the spatial derivatives are large or small compared to the value of the potential. Now, as we saw, when the potential is large compared to the spatial derivatives of the field, then the potential contributes to the energy momentum tensor in the same way that the cosmological constant does, meaning that it contributes to the energy density in with the opposite sign, but equal magnitude as to the pressure. So the overall picture is that there might have been a pre-existing universe just like ours, and everywhere, at all times, as always, fields quantum fluctuate. And then a rare fluctuation happens, just a fluke, where the field quantum fluctuates in a patch a few Planck lengths across in such a way that it is a large that it has a large potential, and the field is not varying much over that patch. When that is the case, then V of 5 will act, as we said, just like a large cosmological constant would. And it would mean that the scale factor blows up exponentially in that region. So before the fluctuation could snap back, which is the picture that we should probably have in mind for quantum fluctuations ordinarily, they happen, but then they just go away again. But quantum fluctuations can also be strong enough so that they are well into the nonlinear regime and the space-time just expands and it kind of mushrooms out from the starting patch. So this here is symbolizing a patch of the pre-existing universe. Here's the patch in it in which the potential of the inflaton field happens to be temporarily very much elevated, and then that part of the universe would mushroom up. So in this way, a mother universe could spawn a daughter universe. Now, when the potential V of phi is large, it doesn't want to stay large. The potential wants to diminish, and eventually inflation then ends. We will now study how to describe that, and we will follow the most conservative view of this. But it turns out that there's the possibility that inflation might end in the way that we will discuss now, in some region in space-time, and then we have a universe just like the one that we see. But it could be that inflation doesn't end everywhere at the same time, and so that at other places it keeps on going, and then it keeps, it ends at some pocket, but expands further in some others. And even if there's just a little bit left that's inflating, within a very short amount of time, that would become a very, very large region again. And it turns out it's actually a generic prediction of inflationary scenarios. Not all of them, but most of them would predict that inflation is actually internal in that way. But we will here focus on just one of those patches. So one patch has this elevated potential. Space-time mushrooms out to a huge volume very quickly. And then inflation comes to an end. It may be that inflation elsewhere continues, so that in hindsight, our place where the inflation came to an end is actually relatively small. So in principle, we could have all these, we could have that inflation just keeps, oh my God. All right, so as I said, inflation could in principle keep going, just occasionally inflation would end here, would end there, and we get some pocket universes in which the universe does not keep on inflating. We will focus on one of those. So here's an example of how this could look like concretely. Here's an example of an inflaton potential, V of phi. And this is a potential that is relatively flat near to the origin, and then it drops, and then it rises again. Drawn this way, you will find it in lots of textbooks. And it may not look like a naturally occurring potential, but actually it is quite natural. We know only of one other scalar field, and it has that kind of potential. And that's the Higgs field. The Higgs field of particle physics has a potential which is described by minus a quadratic term plus a term to the fourth power. And if you plot that, it has this shape, the famous Mexican hat shape. And if you plot it over just the absolute value, so you get just one side of it, it looks roughly like this. So the potential of the inflaton field might look like this. In fact, there is still a possibility in the parameter space that the Higgs field might be the inflaton field. But it's generally assumed that it's not, that it's a separate thing. Okay, so it could be that the potential looks like something like this. Of the inflaton potential. In practice, people are writing down something like they're writing down a Taylor expansion of the potential, and then the coefficients we try to fix from experimental data. So if a field, like the scalar field, has a potential like that, then it wants to sit here at the lowest energy state, which is not where phi is minimal. Phi zero is here. And with a potential like that, the value of the field, the magnitude of the field, would be somewhere over there. This is an example of what is called spontaneous symmetry breaking. But it's not actually important for the purpose of cosmology that this is a case of spontaneous symmetry breaking. The potential might also be simply shifted in such a way that the zero, the minimum, is at zero. It doesn't really matter what the actual value of the field phi is for the purpose of cosmology. The only thing that matters in cosmology is the value of the potential. But if, for example, the Higgs field is the inflaton field, then that's what we would be dealing with. The zero is a little bit offset. Okay, so the normal state would be where the field phi has a vacuum expectation value, where it's but the value of phi is somewhere at an elevated level. But then, and that would be the normal situation throughout the universe. But then it could be that the quantum fluctuation of the field takes the value of the field somewhere into the region where the potential is very large. So imagine that we are considering a universe in which a scalar field has this type of potential. Almost everywhere, the field is fluctuating simply around zero. But there is a patch where the field fluctuated into a region where its potential is tremendously large. Any questions so far?
If a dark universe just spontaneously appeared right there,
right,
would you be able to measure that any way?
Depends on how close. I suppose if it mushroomed out from right here in the immediate neighborhood, I would expect an impact, but not if it's far away. It wouldn't necessarily have to push anything outwards because it creates its own space.
So I was wondering how that would change sort of the metric near it.
I would think that there would be an effect. It would propagate outwards at the speed of light. There would be some, yeah. Mm-hmm. There have been conjectures that There have been conjectures that multiple such bubbles that could form would collide, and then they could influence each other, and that could be seen in the sky. I suppose spawnings of daughter universes.
So something like a solitons, for example?
No, I don't think it would be solitons. Solitons would be, why do you say soliton?
I just said a bunch of bubbles, that's the first thing.
Oh, I see. No. Yeah, so people have been looking at that in the sky and looking at the CMB and seeing if there are any anomalies, but I think nothing that risen to a high statistical significance has been found. Some people say that something has been found with a significance of about 90%, but that's nowhere near, I mean, it's not even 2 sigma. So it's not a discovery. Did anybody read as far in the Atlantic article as Boltzmann brains? Anybody read the article in the Atlantic? I think it's mind-blowing, actually. It's very interesting. Well, one of the things that come out of eternal inflation, you know, when inflation doesn't end everywhere, but keeps on going, and new universes get spawned and so on, and then we have this huge thing. And there would be so much space created, if that's right, that there's a finite probability for almost anything to happen somewhere. For example, that spontaneously matter would assemble into a brain that just dreams the whole thing. Yeah. Yeah, I think it's nonsense, but it's a little difficult to dismiss because basically what you have is things whose probability of occurring is approaching basically zero, but you have infinitely many opportunities for it to happen, and then that limit has to be taken of, you know, the unlikeliness for it to happen in any given volume multiplied with how many of those volumes there actually are. And so it's difficult to dismiss.
Based on our priors, right? Our interpretation of reality itself.
Yes, that...
The probability factor takes those priors.
Yes. Well, that's right. I mean, there is a physical measure, we would like to derive a probability measure, but even if we had a probability measure, it might not be the thing to look at, because everything is predicated on the assumption that we exist and we observe, and that affects the probabilities. Yeah. I think overall there's a real risk that we will find, by studying cosmology, that the universe is likely to be part of something much bigger that unfortunately we don't have experimental access to. That would be terrible. It would be really terrible. If we just had some hint it's part of something bigger. Fixed it? Great. Thanks a lot, Craig. Okay.
So in this picture, the five subscript C is the average value of the field?
Like yes, it's the expectation value of the field. That's right. I think I mentioned it previously at some point in this course, that this kind of picture plays a huge role in particle physics.
Yeah, yeah.
Because a scalar field that has a vacuum expectation value that's not zero provides a scalar that's dynamical. And that scalar can provide, can play the role of other scalars in the scale, in the standard model, such as the scalars which are the masses of the particles.
But not the Klein-Gordon field. The Klein-Gordon field has an expectation value at zero, right?
This is a Klein-Gordon field. A Klein-Gordon field is simply a scalar field.
Okay.
And whether it is, and that's just a matter of the potential that you choose for the Klein-Gordon field.
But the one that we have been looking at is just a phi squared term. This has to have a different, more complicated potential.
Yes, for example, the Higgs field would have a phi squared term, but with a negative coefficient. And then a phi to the 4 term with a positive coefficient, and that gives you that. Okay. All right, so let us look at a concrete model here. Here's how the Klein-Gordon equation looks like when we take into account the potential, but we drop all space dependence. So let us just look at the evolution of the zero mode, of the zero K mode, of the constant part of the field. Later on, we will split the Klein-Gordon field into the inflaton field into its zero mode, which is to say the part of the Klein-Gordon field that is constant in space, only varies in time. That's the part that we are dealing with here, which is what we will treat classically. And then all the non-zero modes, the fluctuations around spatial isotropy and homogeneity, those fluctuations will be considered small. They will be treated perturbatively, and they will be quantized. Whereas the field phi itself is large, and it will be, we will assume that its expectation value is large compared to its fluctuations. And so we will treat it classically. And for the metric, we will do a similar thing. We will split a zero mode part of the metric from the non-zero modes of the metric. The zero mode part of the metric describes the bulk of the space-time, the homogeneous and isotropic part. And then the non-zero modes describe fluctuations, and we will quantize those. So the Klein-Gordon equation is this if we drop the space derivatives, but we do keep the potential here. So we are looking now at the bulk of the inflaton field, and it has this dynamics. Now, what's the dynamics like? What is this? What kind of a differential equation is this? So what it says is that the second time derivative of the amplitude of the field is equal to minus the potential differentiated by the field. This is just like in classical mechanics, where phi is x, is the elongation, is the position of something. And then we would say that the acceleration of it is minus potential differentiated with respect to x. In other words, the force. Right? So what it says is that it is the acceleration is governed by a force, which derives from a potential. Except there's also this term. And that term is proportional to phi dot, first derivative, so it's a friction type term. What this means is that we can visualize the dynamics of the inflaton field in the following way. Here we plot phi and the potential of phi again, and you can think of it as if it was an ordinary classical mechanical problem where instead of phi we have x, the position, and v is the potential. It could be literally a height. It could be just gravitational height, potential energy. The same differential equation, if phi was x and this was an object such as a metal ball which is rolling down some potential. So if this was a ordinary mechanical problem, what would we have? We would have that this object, if it has a bit of a motion in this direction, would start rolling this way or sliding this way. I don't want to deal with rotational energy here. Let's say it's sliding this way, and then eventually it accelerates down here, and then it goes like that until eventually it comes to a standstill here at the minimum because of the friction term, right? It will not just bounce back, but instead it will slowly come down there faster, faster, and then oscillate like this. So that's the dynamics that's described by the Klein-Gordon equation for the inflaton field. So this term just acts like a force, and that term acts like a friction term. Now, we will make the assumption here that this actually has a bit of a slope. This part should not be completely flat. If I drew it too flat, I'm sorry about it, it should really actually be having a little bit of a slope. For example, for the Higgs field, it does have a slope because it would be, you know, going like this. Minus phi squared plus phi to the fourth. And the reason for that little bit of slope will become clear in a moment. First, the definition. If the initial value of v of phi is very large, and if the initial slope is very flat, but not completely flat, so then this ball in the mechanical analogy rolls down slowly that hill with an approximately constant v of phi, then we speak of slow roll inflation. So normally the field is here. We are assuming that at some point, in a rare fluke, the quantum field fluctuated to this place, where it was at a high potential, high value of the potential, and then it had to get down from that. And the Klein-Gordon equation describes how it does get down from that, namely with a slow roll down that slope, and then eventually oscillating there. So that scenario, that overall picture, is called slow roll inflation. Now, why would that be an interesting scenario? Well, let's make this observation. During the slow roll period, so while the phi field is up here and slowly moving in this way, so that the potential slowly diminishes, but roughly stays constant, it just a little bit goes down. While that is happening, we have in particular that the potential dominates over the phi dot squared term. You see, we assumed that the field phi fluctuated not only in to somewhere here where the potential was very large. We also assumed that the field phi was relatively homogeneous, relatively constant in that patch where it had a large potential. And the reason why we ask for that is that this means that the potential v of phi dominates over the spatial derivatives in the energy momentum term. Remember the energy momentum tensor for a Klein-Gordon field had spatial derivatives of phi, time derivatives of phi, and the potential of phi. We want that the potential dominates because the potential term is scalar. Therefore, it has to contribute to the energy momentum tensor as a multiple of the metric. And that is exactly also what the cosmological constant does. A scalar term can only add to the energy momentum tensor proportional to the metric. And therefore, as the same way as a cosmological constant term, and therefore in a way which will make the space-time blow up exponentially. So we've so far asked that the fluctuation, the initial fluctuation, was relatively homogeneous in space. Now, by assuming that the potential was relatively flat up here, we can also conclude then that the time derivative in phi was also relatively small, and that's something we need. We need that the time and the space derivatives of phi are small compared to the potential, so that the potential, while phi was moving this way, so that the potential, while it is moving this way, was relatively constant. Now, you also see why we want a little bit of a slope. We want a little bit of a slope so that it actually moves this way, so that inflation has a chance to eventually end. If there was a dip in here, it would just forever sit there, and we would just have inflation going on forever.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
We're treating the 0-1 as a classical object, so how can we say that it fluctuates to a high value?
Yes, we are assuming that. We are assuming that it's, in principle, it is a quantum variable, and we're assuming it's a super rare fluctuation. And then we say that, okay, assume the super rare fluctuation has happened, and then it needs to get out of this. And so then, in principle, in fact, that is the reason why we expect that there's internal inflation. In principle, you're right. If it used a quantum fluctuation to get from here to there, then why should we consider it to roll down classically this way? Now, the simple argument is that the expectation value up here would be much larger than the uncertainty, and it would be a good approximation to assume that we can work here with the classical calculations. But then you might counter, well, yeah, but if it fluctuated once so dramatically, it might fluctuate again so dramatically. It might, for example, roll down all the way here and then fluctuate back up there. It might, but the chances are super, super small. But since there is a chance for this to happen, there is quite a chance that somewhere in the universe it actually does happen. Right, so the universe is getting enormous during that period, because this is going to be the period during which there is going to be exponential expansion, high potential. Potential is large compared to the derivative. We have quasi-exponential expansion here, and enormous amounts of volume are being created. And there's a fair chance that somewhere in this huge volume, a fluctuation might take it up there again. Which means that, yeah, in most of the places, it will just go down like that classically. But there is enough space being created that there's a significant probability for inflation to not end, but instead, you know, it might also fluctuate back. And that would mean that, yes, in principle, it ends, but at some location, it continues, or some locations, it continues. And those spaces become even bigger very, very quickly. And again, the same thing. They would want to roll down the potential, but there could be some rare fluctuation that pushes it back up again. And then you have what is called eternal inflation, which spawn pocket universes. And in each pocket universe, of course, from scratch, inflation could start again.
So when you have this initial fluctuation, you have a lot of energy in one place, right? Like potential value?
Yeah.
So by Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, won't that want to spread out as well?
What do you mean by that?
Can it spread out or just erase itself immediately? Like,
it's subtle, actually, because remember that the uncertainty principle doesn't speak about the value of the energy itself. It speaks about the uncertainty in the energy.
Right.
This
is different than like having a bunch of energy confined in one place.
Well, yeah, that's basically what it is. There is an elevated energy along with negative pressure, homogeneously distributed over some patch that's large enough that it makes sense to say that it's homogeneous. Because if it's homogeneous at sub-Planckian scales, we don't believe that homogeneity makes sense at smaller than Planckian scales. But if it's a few Planck lengths across and it's homogeneous, then yeah, we would say that this is energy concentrated. And then what happens is that the whole thing blows up. There's no energy conservation in general relativity, and the energy density actually remains the same. The energy is not diluting, right? The energy density just remains the same as the space-time is expanding. For example, for a cosmological constant, same deal. With a cosmological constant that dominates, we also have that the universe expands dramatically, but the cosmological constant is a constant energy density. Energy density is being created.
I was like kind of wondering if just like a balance between like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle doing its thing and general relativity taking over and causing it to expand.
Like, in a way, you can view it this way, I suppose. You could say that the fluctuation has to have a long enough duration. Yeah, because if it's too short, then the time derivatives are of the same order or larger than the potential, and then the potential can't do the trick of making the whole thing launch. So you need that the energy is elevated for long enough for this whole thing to take hold. Right, so the observation is that if our potential is the way we describe up here, if there is slow roll, then right, by definition of slow, and we mean that it is sloped enough or not too much sloped, if this term is small compared to the potential. Because in this case, the so-called equation of state parameter, which if you remember, is the pressure divided by the energy density, it's the TII component divided by the T00 component, that then becomes close to minus 1. And if you remember from our earlier calculations, the closer W is to to minus 1, the closer is the resulting expansion of the universe, the scale factor, to being exponential. If this was exactly minus 1, we would have exactly exponential expansion. So what we have then is that during a slow roll period, up here, we'll see it in the equations in a moment. What we have here is that V of phi dominates. Phi dot is not all that great. So V of phi dominates. It acts like a cosmological constant. And therefore, we will have an almost exponential expansion where the Hubble constant is expressible in terms of the potential. But it won't actually be a constant because the potential is slowly diminishing, which means that the Hubble constant, well, then called the Hubble parameter, will also slowly be diminished. Now, if you remember our calculations of the quantum fluctuations, remember, one of the things we calculated is that the quantum fluctuations are proportional to H, to the Hubble constant. So what we see then is that there should be a slight change in the size of the quantum fluctuations as we go along there. They should have a different spectrum, a different amplitude over time. So there should be more quantum fluctuations for the earlier modes and fewer quantum fluctuations for the later modes because the potential for the later modes is a little bit smaller. So the Hubble constant should be a bit smaller. So the horizon should be a little larger. So the quantum fluctuations will have decayed a little bit more before they froze. And amazingly, that prediction has been, there's been experimental evidence found for that from the WMAP and the Planck satellite recordings of the measurements of the cosmic microwave background. It was predicted before it was measured. That the so-called spectral index, we will get to this in great detail, is running a little bit. We need that because inflation would never end otherwise. So, right, so let's confirm though that we actually get with this model what we want, namely temporary quasi-exponential inflation. So let us look at the zero-zero component of the Einstein equation. Here it is again. Here's the cosmological constant. Here is the zero-zero component of the energy momentum tensor. We will assume that the cosmological constant is zero. The cosmological constant is probably not zero because of recent measurements of it. But compared to the energy scales that we're dealing with in the early universe, it's basically zero. It's dozens and dozens of orders of magnitude smaller than this. So the zero-zero component of the Einstein equation looks like this, where we can drop the cosmological constant because this thing is dominant. And it is dominated by our inflaton field. Now, the inflaton field produces here the V of phi in here in T naught naught. I mean, there's also the space and time derivatives of phi, but we assume that they are negligible. So what we obtain is that during the slow roll period, A dot over A squared is approximately 8 pi g third times the potential, where this is slowly changing, slowly diminishing over time. But that means that A dot over A is almost constant, right? Because if this is almost constant, A dot over A is almost constant, but that means that the first derivative is proportional to itself, it's exponential, right? So what we obtain is that if A dot over A is approximately this, then A of T is approximately that. It's the initial scale factor. The scale factor is some initial scale factor times some exponential factor, where the exponential factor, you can easily calculate from that. You know, you have to take the square root of this. Is given by this. If you compare with the calculation for the Sitter space that we did earlier, this is just the scale factor for the Sitter space with this thing being h, the Hubble constant. But now it's no longer constant because the potential is slowly diminishing. So now it's the Hubble parameter. Of course, if this was quickly changing, then the whole thing would, the approximation would fall apart. And eventually, it will be quickly changing when the thing goes downhill and then oscillates down there. But in the slow roll regime, that's what we get. So in the slow roll regime, we have effectively a slowly varying Hubble parameter. So we have almost exponential expansion. It would be exactly exponential if this was constant, but because this is diminishing, this is e to the power of t times something which is not quite constant, but diminishing a little bit. So that function, a dot over a, is then called the Hubble parameter function. We used to write it like this, e to the power ht in the Sitter space. And that is a special case here. But in the case of a slow roll inflation and of realistic slow roll inflation, we have that h of t is given by this expression in terms of the potential. So as the potential slowly decreases, also the Hubble parameter decreases, which means that the Hubble horizon increases. Right? Very important. The more dramatic the expansion is, so the larger h is, the smaller is the size of the horizon, and vice versa. As h decreases, so the coefficient in the exponent decreases, the expansion becomes less dramatic, and the horizon becomes larger. But the larger the horizon, the smaller are the quantum fluctuations. Because remember how the logic went. The quantum fluctuations in Minkowski space are large at small scales, and the quantum fluctuations are small at large scales. And if we take a mode that's of a tiny wavelength, initially it doesn't see the expansion. And so initially it has large fluctuations, then because of this expansion of the universe, the wavelength expands. But now it's a mode with a larger wavelength, so it has smaller quantum fluctuations. And the wavelength grows, so the quantum fluctuations get smaller. But eventually, the wavelength reaches the Hubble horizon. And then, as we calculated, the size of the quantum fluctuations no longer diminishes. After that, for the rest of inflation, the quantum fluctuations size stays the same, stays constant. So depending on when the mode crossed the Hubble horizon, it will either have larger or smaller quantum fluctuations later at the end of inflation. If it crossed the Hubble horizon when the Hubble horizon was large, well, then it already had small fluctuations. It doesn't have many fluctuations at the end of inflation. But if a mode crossed the Hubble horizon when the Hubble horizon was still very small, then the mode crossed the Hubble horizon when it still had a lot of fluctuations and then kept those. As I said, that very phenomenon has been captured by the WMAP and Planck satellites. So then inflation had to eventually end. So the period of inflation is the period from eta initial to eta final in our previous notation. And the eta initial and eta final would be the beginning and the end of the slow roll period. Well, and then eventually our zero mode of the phi field drops down that hill and then oscillates here until by the friction it will slowly come to a standstill. Now you may wonder, where does the energy go? And it turns out that the energy that was in here, in the V of phi, in this process here, gets converted into the production of all sorts of particles. Now that's in principle a rather complicated process. And it involves the coupling of the inflaton field to all the other fields, quarks, electrons, photons, and gluons, and all of those. But the end result of it is that the energy had to go somewhere, and it will go into the production of all those fields. And that end point, when then inflation ends at this point where the field is at its minimum, that is actually the point where we would say that the hot Big Bang starts. So ordinary hot Big Bang cosmology goes from today back to this point in time, where the universe was large, flat, and filled with tremendously hot gas. So the overall picture is that a mother universe spawned a daughter universe. It still is crazy to say these things. It feels crazy to say that. But that's how it looks like. A spawned a daughter universe, and the inflation that did it came to a standstill at some point, and the energy density that was tremendous, tremendously high and spread over the entire universe, all of that went into the production of particles. So at the end of inflation, we have a very, very hot plasma. And I'm saying plasma because it couldn't be a gas. It's way too hot for that. Charges would not stick together. Not even quarks would stick together. It was way too hot for that. But then, of course, the expansion continued, not in an inflationary, that is to say, not in an accelerated way, but it continued. The universe cooled down, and then eventually, some 100, 300,000 years later, it was cold enough for protons and electrons to stick together, and then the universe became transparent and filled with mostly hydrogen gas and a little bit of helium gas. And all the photons that were around at that time suddenly found themselves free to travel. Previously, they had bounced off charges, but now they just find neutral hydrogen, which is a transparent gas. So that's the time then when the cosmic microwave background was created.
Is there any way of calculating the distribution of particles that would be created from the end of inflation?
In principle, yes. I'm not sure whether there's agreement on that. It's a difficult thing because in principle, we would need to know the standard model to higher energies, and we do know it, in order to actually calculate those processes.
We pretended we did.
Yeah, then we could. But it's not completely necessary to actually know all these things, because all those heavy particles are presumably not stable. And the stable particles we think we know. I mean, the standard model has only very few stable particles, and all the rest are unstable. So we know what it all ends up in. And so if you just assume that after a little while, after the initial thermalization of this, we basically have a thermal state, then it's easy. Once you have a thermal state, it's easy, because you can basically look at the energy that it costs to have this state or that state, you know, this distribution of particles, that distribution of particles. And each configuration gets its own Boltzmann factor and can calculate the thermal distribution there. But it's a highly non-trivial business that goes way beyond what we do in this course. For example, this is, I mean, right after inflation ends, this is the point where the particle-antiparticle asymmetry must have been created somehow. And the current thinking is, has been for decades, that this asymmetry must have to do with time reversal non-symmetry and some non-tonality in that so-called reheating process. Super complicated stuff. And by the way, that period of heating the universe, of turning the energy in the inflaton field into a hot plasma, that period is called reheating, which is a bit of a misnomer because we didn't have a preheating. Well, in this standard simplest picture, there is no prior heating. So it's just called reheating for no really good reason. So basically what the ambition of the inflationary program is to deliver the initial conditions for conventional hot Big Bang theory. A universe that's flat because of the tremendous expansion, everything non-flat that might have been there was just basically ironed out because it was enlarged by a tremendous factor. The universe was emptied of things like monopoles and other things. Just by dilution. And then it was refilled with a fresh batch of plasma created from the inflaton potential, which are presumably the initial conditions for ordinary hot Big Bang theory. And by hot Big Bang theory, what I mean is the study of the cool down of the universe. Start with a tremendously hot plasma, and when you calculate the various phase transitions that it underwent, until today. For example, at some point it was cold enough for the quarks to find themselves together and form protons and neutrons. And then sometime later it was cold, when the universe was about a second old. And then, a second after the end of inflation. And then about 300,000 years later was when electrons and protons would start sticking together. All right, so this was, we'll come back to that, but I just want to give you an idea of how one can imagine inflation to have started and to have ended. Now let's see what quantum fluctuations are being generated in this way. So the strategy will be this. We assume that there's a suitable potential V of phi, something of that kind, which could be like the Higgs potential or maybe something else. And suitable initial conditions, as we discussed before, conditions that were created by a fluke. Fluke fluctuations. So we assume that we have solutions for the zero modes, phi zero of t, and also the scale factor, which exhibit slow roll inflation for a suitable finite time interval. Now we talked about the fact that we will take the inflaton field and separate off the zero mode, the constant part, which we will treat classically, and the non-zero modes, the fluctuations in space, the inhomogeneities, which we will assume to be small, we will treat them perturbatively and quantize them. But we will have to also do the same procedure for the metric itself. So in particular, we will have a kind of zero mode for the scale factor. The scale factor assumed to be everywhere constant. So we indicate that with a zero down here. Or that's, if later we will do it in a proper way where we take the metric and decompose it into a zero mode that is constant everywhere and fluctuations of the metric. But just looking at the zero modes, what we assuming here is that the scalar fields zero mode and the zero mode, the constant part of the scale factor, obey the equations that we just discussed, namely the simplified, I mean the homogeneous isotropic part of the Einstein equation and the Klein-Gordon equation. Right, and so now let's make this this decomposition explicit. So we have here the inferton field in all its glory, and we decompose it into the zero mode of it, phi, with a subscript zero that we will treat classically and non-perturbatively. You know, the whole rolling down the hill and so on, that's not linear stuff. So we do that non-perturbatively, and then we also consider the perturbations of the inflaton field around spatial homogeneity. So the total inflaton field is the sum of these two contributions. This will be treated classically non-perturbatively, and this will be treated quantumly perturbatively. And all of this hinges on the assumption that this approximation is good, that the fluctuations are small compared to what the zero mode is doing. But, as I said, this means that we must also consider small fluctuations in the metric. We must do a similar decomposition for the metric. And the reason is that the inflaton field is not really independent of the metric, and the metric is not independent of the inflaton field. They're related by the Einstein equation. You see, in inflationary theory, we are always assuming that the largest contribution to the energy-momentum tensor stems from the inflaton field. And here it is. This is the energy-momentum tensor of the Klein-Gordon field, of the inflaton field. And here it is with its space and time derivatives, space and time derivatives, mass term, and the potential. So now the Einstein equation is this. And we see that this stuff here on the left-hand side, which is made out of the metric, is affected by the energy-momentum tensor. So in particular, if the inflaton field is fluctuating, then the energy-momentum tensor will. And that means there's going to be fluctuations in the metric. We can't have the field fluctuate without the metric fluctuating, especially if that field is considered to be the dominant field in the Einstein equation. So any inhomogeneities of phi of x will induce inhomogeneities in G mu of x.
Achim,
mm-hmm.
Thinking back to normal quantum mechanics, when we have an operator, what does it mean for the operator to fluctuate? It means that if we measure it, we get a different result every time. But here, what is measuring what? Like, I don't understand.
Okay, so in principle, the phi, the var phi variable, we will treat quantum mechanically. And so there will be uncertainties. It will be described as an operator-valued function of space and time. There will be uncertainties. And they enter into the Einstein equation. And normally, we would just throw up our hands and say, well, the left-hand side we can't quantize. The metric we can't quantize. So what we normally do in the Einstein equation would be to say, let's just take the expectation value here and then leave that classical. But we will here do an approximation. We will do a linear approximation of this stuff. And then it becomes just like a Klein-Gordon equation too, but for the perturbations of the metric. So the perturbations of the metric can then also be described by something like a Klein-Gordon equation, which is driven on the right-hand side by these contributions from the Klein-Gordon field. In other words, we will not simply take the expectation value here, but we will say we have an operator here, we have operators there, just for the inhomogeneous part, just for the part that we can treat linearly. So how do we do that? So we will consider also small inhomogeneities in the metric. So we take the metric tensor, which, remember, is not some arbitrary metric tensor. It is the metric tensor of some inflationary scenario, which means that in the bulk, mostly, it is simply the Minkowski metric multiplied with the scale factor. So that would be a good approximation. Forget about this stuff. That would be a good approximation. The metric is scale factor times Minkowski space. Right? Remember, that's the FRW. These are the FRW models. But we improve on it a little bit by saying, OK, the metric is going to be that FRW metric plus some gamma mu nu of x and eta, where this is some perturbation, some small thing. It might be zero, but generally we allow this thing to be fluctuating. And we will actually treat that quantum mechanically. Not this, but that we will treat quantum mechanically. We will make a distinction, just like a separation of degrees of freedom, just like for the inflaton field, where we have a zero mode part that you will treat classically and non-perturbatively. And then we have a non-zero mode part, part that is spatially varying, but assumed very small. We will treat it in linear approximation, the differential equations in linear approximation, which means for the potential for the action in quadratic approximation. And quantum mechanically with hats over them. Now, all of this is much easier said than done. It took about 20 years of papers that were not quite right until eventually this thing was settled. And I'll show you in a moment why it was so difficult. OK, so in principle, we would like, of course, to solve the full quantum theory of g mu nu of hat, g mu nu hat of x, and phi hat of x without any of this separating and approximating and so on. But that's too hard. And it's not just too hard analytically. It just doesn't seem consistent so far. Don't really have any consistent ways of doing it. But in lowest order perturbation theory, we can proceed like this. we assume this to be the FRW background solution that we obtain from some sort of slow roll potential. And we assume that we have a phi naught of eta that goes along with that, all of which are completely homogeneous and isotropic. So truly the zero modes, and they are classical. And then we quantize just the phi hat of x, just the non-zero modes for the inflaton field and the non-zero modes for the metric. So that's the strategy. Now, why does this approximation help? Well, it turns out that, by construction, that if the phi and the gamma can be assumed small in some sense, then the equations of motions are effectively linear in these operators. And that's great, because we have methods to solve the quantum field theory for this case. So in the action, the equations of motion are linear, quadratic terms can be neglected, and in the action, everything is quadratic and higher order stuff can be neglected. Higher degree polynomial stuff can be neglected. And so in particular, the phi will obey a free Klein-Gordon equation without any potential. However, there are two things that we have to keep in mind before we launch into this strategy. There are two sources of non-triviality. First of all, there's this interdependence between the quantum fluctuations of the field phi, of the inflaton field, and of the metric. We mentioned that briefly before, but let me just say it again. Much of the inhomogeneities of the metric will be induced by the inhomogeneities of the inflaton field because of the Einstein equation. And vice versa, you can also say that much of the fluctuations of the inflaton field are induced by the fluctuations of the metric. you can read the Einstein equation one way or the other. You can say that the energy momentum tensor is causing curvature, or you can say that the curvature is causing an energy momentum tensor. But either way, the degrees of freedom in the interton field are not independent of those of the metric. These operators obey equalities. So the inflaton field's inhomogeneities, their quantum fluctuations, cannot be separated from those of the metric. And secondly, we need to keep in mind that the metric has more degrees of freedom than the inflaton field, which is clear because the metric is not scalar. The inflaton field is scalar. The metric contains more degrees of freedom than a scalar because it's a rank 2 covariant tensor. That's more degrees of freedom. So what we'll need to do is identify which degrees of freedom of the metric are related through the Einstein equation to the degrees of freedom of the inflaton field. And not just related, but equal, right? Because the Einstein equation is setting them equal. It says this operator is that operator. And we will try to identify which degrees of freedom in the metric are independent of the inflaton field. You've seen an analog of that before in electromagnetism. See, when you look at the Einstein equation, where is it? When you look at the Einstein equation here, what you have is the metric, and the metric is driven by, it's affected by what the energy momentum tensor does. The usual picture is that you place energy and mass and pressure and so on into your space-time, and that will curve space-time. This is mathematically similar, and to some extent physically similar, to electromagnetism, where you have currents and charges on the right-hand side, and you have the electric and the magnetic fields on the left-hand side. And you know that from that example, you know that there are parts of the electromagnetic field which are immediately and directly caused by the charges and currents. But there are also parts of the electromagnetic field that can exist even where there are no charges and no currents, namely traveling waves that just pass through, for example. Or, for example, the electrostatic field of a charge. The field is non-zero here, but the charge is over there. In electromagnetism, you have the inhomogeneous Maxwell equations, which tell you if there's a charge and a current right here, then right here also there must be this much electric and magnetic field. But there are also other equations of Maxwell equations, which tell you that electric fields can induce magnetic fields, and magnetic fields can induce electric fields. There may not be any charges or currents around, but there are still fields around. And similar it is with the metric and with curvature. Wherever there is mass and energy, there must be curvature right there too, at the same location. But there can be curvature even where there is no mass or energy. And that extra curvature, for example, gravitational waves, is not directly coupled to the inflaton field. This will be having its own degrees of freedom, its own operators, its own quantum fluctuations. So we will identify in the metric contributions that directly coupled to the Klein-Gordon field, to the Einstein equation, and other contributions to the metric that are independent of that. Right. Okay, so gravity is a force with some similarity to electromagnetism. Some electromagnetic fields only exist because they are charges or currents, but also some electromagnetic fields are self-sustaining. They are existing independently with their own dynamics. So in particular, remember the electric field. It's a three vector in three space. It can be decomposed into what may be called a scalar path and what may be called a vector path. And by that I mean the scalar part of the electric field is a part that can be derived from a scalar, that can be represented by a scalar. It's the gradient part. Right? Remember that the electric field can always be decomposed into a gradient field plus a curl field. And the gradient field is always the gradient of a scalar, and a curl field is, well, the curl of a vector field. So the electric field can always be decomposed into that gradient part and that curl part, the gradient part being directly induced by charges or by charge densities, but this is not caused by charge densities or by current densities, this is caused by magnetic fields. So the scalar part of the electric field is the gradient of a scalar function of an electrostatic potential. I should have chosen a different variable than lambda. This has nothing to do with the cosmological constant. It's just a scalar electrostatic potential. And then the vector part of the electric field is the curl of some vector potential. And they obey certain equations. For example, a gradient field never has any curl, and a curl field never has any divergence. We will see analogs of all of this for gravity as well. Gravity is just a little bit more complicated. But in principle, in spirit, it's the same thing. So now, according to the Maxwell equations, the scalar part, so ES, the thing that is the gradient of a scalar field, is caused by the charge density, by the electric charge density. The divergence of it is given by the charge density. So the gradient part of an electric field can exist only where there is actually at the same location a charge density. But the curl part doesn't need that. The curl part can exist where there are no charges and no current. Because the curl part can arise from a change in the magnetic field. And of course, a similar analysis can be done for the magnetic field, and we find that the magnetic field can be induced by a changing electric field, and that's why we have electromagnetic fields, because electric field and magnetic fields decay and create another in such a way that we have a propagating electromagnetic wave. And similarly, also in gravity, gravitational waves have a similar self-induction process. So now, similarly, some curvature exists only where there's energy momentum. But also, some curvature is self-sustaining with dynamics, for example, gravitational waves. So we should expect that the perturbation of the metric, gamma mu nu, the thing that we want to describe quantum mechanically, so we should expect that the perturbation of the metric away from the just FRW homogeneous isotropic metric, we should expect that this perturbation of the metric contains two contributions. Some contribution, which describes curvature that's induced by the inflaton inhomogeneities, where the inflaton fields inhomogeneities play the role of charge density in the comparison, the analogy with electric field. But the perturbation of the metric should also contain some part of the curvature which is self-sustaining, that can possess its own dynamics, and that is having its own quantum fluctuation. So how can we separate these inhomogeneities? In the metric. Well, remember what we did for vector fields. Vector fields that mapped R3 into R3, where we decomposed the electric field into a gradient and a curl part, where the defining feature of the gradient part was that it is obtained by taking derivatives of a scalar function, of an electrostatic potential. And the defining feature of the curl part was that it is obtained by taking derivatives of a vector field, of a vector potential. So similarly here, the perturbations gamma mu nu of the metric tensor can also be decomposed into three types. There is a part of gamma mu nu which at any point in time can be obtained by from scalar functions, suitable derivatives of scalar functions or scalar functions directly. And then there's a part of the perturbations of the metric which can be derived from vector fields. And if this was electromagnetism, that would be the end of it. But you see, in the case of electromagnetism, the electric field is just a vector field. And so parts of it can be obtained from a scalar field, parts of it from a vector field, but that's it. But the metric is a two-tensor. So it goes one step further. We have a part of it that can be obtained from a scalar function, a part that can, or from scalar functions in general, a part that can be obtained from vector functions, and a part that cannot be obtained from any one of these, a part that is truly tensorial. It's the leftover part that cannot be expressed using vectors or scalars, that is purely tensorial. Okay, so let's do this decomposition of the metric with respect to its spatial structure. Well, we do this at every point in time, we do this decomposition. And about the ambiguity of how we define equal time, well, we'll have to get back to that a little later. So it will be convenient to write the metric not as G mu nu of x and eta as a 4x4 matrix, but it will be convenient to write the metric in this way. We write the line element, the invariant distance between two infinitesimally separated points in this way. So ds squared is G mu nu dx mu dx mu, where the dx mu is given by these components, where the x are co-moving distances and the eta are conformal time. Then the decomposition of the metric goes in this way. The full metric is the FRW metric, which is simply the Minkowski metric multiplied with a squared. Remember that in co-moving coordinates and using conformal time, the metric was simply scale factor squared times the Minkowski metric, right? So that's what we have here. And then we have three additional contributions: a scalar part, a vector part, a tensor part, in the same way that the electric field could be decomposed into a scalar part, which is a gradient, and a vector part, that's a curl. Here, how does the scalar part look like? How does the vector part, how does the tensor part look like? Well, here's the scalar part. And what this is simply the collection of everything. It's simply all possibilities for obtaining a covariant symmetric two-tensor using scalars. Spatial scalars. So this is always, for every point in time, this is a decomposition in space, just like for the electric field or for the magnetic field. In this expression, this capital phi here is some scalar function. This capital B is some scalar function. That capital psi is a scalar function, and so is that capital E. This has nothing to do with the magnetic or electric field, and because it's just gravity, and phi and psi are also just some scalar fields. All this is saying is that the metric will have contributions which are from d eta squared, contributions which are d eta dxi, and contributions which are space-space, so dxi, dxj. Now, in order to get the tensorial properties right, what we have is that this is a spatial scalar. That's fine, so that's already having the right structure. But here we have a spatial vector index. It needs to be contracted with something. What we have available is just a scalar function. It doesn't have an index that we could contract it with. So we need to differentiate it in order to get a spatial scalar out of this. And then here we have the two space coordinates. So we need to have two indices, spatial indices I and j, to contract these with to get spatially a scalar. And we can do that in two ways. You can either just take the Kronecker delta ij, which is the only two-tensor, canonical two-tensor that's available. We can contract them and then multiply what we get with some scalar function that will make it tensorially of the right structure. Or we can take a scalar function, differentiate it twice. This way we also get two indices, two spatial indices I and j, which we then can contract here. So these are all possible ways of getting a spatial scalar using only for a metric, getting the invariant distance from using only scalar functions phi, psi, b, and e. Now that's way more than what we had for the electric field, right? For the electric field, we had only an electrostatic potential for the scalar part. And then there was a vector part, and that was a curl field. So it was as easy as that. But now for the metric, it's much more complicated. So the scalar part was this. But then where these are just some scalar functions. And then it looks like the metric has a lot of degrees of freedom, isn't it? It has alone four degrees, scalar degrees of freedom. It looks like that at the moment. But we will discuss in a moment that it's not actually that many. The number can be reduced. So now, what is this spatially vector part of the metric? So how can we get the invariant distance at any point in time if what is available is vector-valued functions? Okay, well, we can take a vector-valued function, so it has a spatial index I, and contract it with the dxi. That gives us a spatial scalar, so that's a contribution that's legal. We can also take a vector-valued function differentiated with j, and then contract it with the dxj here, so the I index with that index and the j index with this one. But that wouldn't be legal because it wouldn't be symmetric, right? We must have ij symmetry because the metric is symmetric in the interchange of the two indices. So we need, if we take this one, we also need that term here in order to make the whole thing symmetric. So we have just identified here the most general way of writing a contribution to the metric using only vector-valued functions of time and space. And then finally, we also have a spatially tensor part of the metric, which is the remainder. It's that part of the metric which cannot be expressed as derivatives of some other tensor or something like that. So it's truly a tensorial part. So it's a spatial tensor field. So what about these vector fields and this tensor field hij? Maybe I should already, so that you have that in your mind already, the hij are going to describe gravitational waves. The truly tensorial part is going to describe gravitational waves. So what we have is that analogously to the equations for electromagnetism, where we had that the scalar part of the electric field, which is to say the gradient part, had no curl. I mean, it's just a mathematical fact that gradient fields don't have a curl. And it's a mathematical fact that curl fields don't have a divergence. These facts translate now or generalize now for the metric into the purely mathematical facts that these vector fields V and W also are divergence free. And it translates into the fact, well, which doesn't really have an analog in electromagnetism because we don't have a two-tensor field in electromagnetism. The hij obeys the property that it's, of course, symmetric because the metric is. But also it's traceless and it obeys this condition here, which is something like a divergence freeness for every index I. And it turns out that, I mean, if you've taken my course last term, that this means that the hij part of the curvature is a purely Weyl curvature part because it's traceless. Okay, how are we doing with the time? Maybe just a few more minutes. So where are we now? We decomposed the inflaton field into its zero mode that we treated non-perturbatively but classically, and into its perturbation that is depends on space, which we treat perturbatively. We assume it is small, but we quantize it. So that's treated classically, and this is treated quantum mechanically. And similarly, we decompose the metric. G mu nu is written as the FRW metric plus a perturbation that can depend on space and time, but is assumed small and is being quantized. And then we decompose this part. We decompose the perturbation of the metric into a part that is generated by scalar fields, namely these four, a part that's generated by vector fields, namely these two, and a part that's generated by a true tensor field. So the total metric can be written as the FRW metric for basically the zero mode plus a scalar part, a vector part, and a tensor part. And here again are the three expressions for the scalar part, the vector part, and the tensor part. Now, let's take these approximations, and we assume that phi is small and gamma is small, and plug them into the action. The Einstein action and the Klein-Gordon action. And of course, there is also the action for all the other fields, but we neglect that here. And what we obtain, of course, is many terms. Because, can you imagine, we have all of this to plug into it, right? So we get plenty of terms there. Now, these terms can be simplified. But why? Well, you see, space is curved. And now that we no longer are dealing with exact FRW spacetime, now that we allow for inhomogeneities to be in there, there is no longer a preferred foliation of space-time into space like hypersurfaces. There is no preferred choice for a coordinate system. But the choice of coordinate system will affect the functions above. Right? If you do a diffeomorphism, it will have an impact on those scalar, vector, and tensor functions. In other words, these scalar, vector, and tensor functions transform under changes of coordinates. They transform if you change what you call equal time. You change your coordinate system if you change more than just your spatial coordinate system, if you change also your space-time coordinate system. And so in particular, we can choose our space-like hypersurfaces in such a way that these functions, to some extent, vanish or simplify. It took several years, as I mentioned before, several years of questionable accuracy papers until eventually this was all figured out. And for detailed references, look, for example, into those two papers here. It's really tedious math. I don't think we should go into the details of that. We just don't have the time of it. It's very complicated, lengthy stuff. But the result is that for small inhomogeneities, for first order in perturbation theory, nearly all of the variables that we introduced, the scalar, the vector, the tensorial ones, can be eliminated by suitable choices of coordinate system. There are, in effect, just two fields left over that really matter, that we cannot gauge away, that we cannot get rid of, no matter how we choose our coordinate systems. So in particular, what we have is a spatial tensor field. And that is Hij itself. Remember Hij, the thing that I told you has to do with gravitational waves? The component of the metric perturbations that is truly tensorial, that cannot be derived from vectors, from vector fields and scalars. The Hij represents curvature that is independent of t mu nu. It is called Weyl curvature, and it is describing gravitational waves. Intuitively, Hij describes how much space is sort of distorted against itself. You know, in the sense in which a gravitational wave detector is measuring gravitational waves. You know what it takes there? You have to have these two arms and then measure relative times of travel. So that's something that survives, modding out by the choices of equal time hypersurfaces. And secondly, another one more degree of freedom survives. And that is actually, it will turn out that this has 2 degrees of freedom in it. Basically, gravitational waves have 2 polarizations. But this is one type of degrees of freedom, and here's another type of degree of freedom. So this type, we just discussed, independent of the inflaton field. You can have gravitational waves even when there's no matter. Even when the energy momentum tensor is strictly zero, there could still be gravitational waves passing through. The next type of degree of freedom that we are now covering, the second type of and only other degree of freedom that there is the degree of freedom of the metric that is actually caused by the inflaton field. So that other degree of freedom here, and that it took so long to uncover, is made out of both the inflaton field, or the perturbations of the inflaton field, and the perturbation of the metric. And what we have is that the fluctuations of the inflaton field, delta phi, which we wrote as var phi, these fluctuations combined with the Einstein equations, as we said, with the metric, and specifically with that scalar function psi in the metric. You remember the scalar function psi? Let me show it to you again. Here it is. This one. So what we obtain is that the inflaton field contributes on the right-hand side of the Einstein equation. The psi contributes on the left-hand side of the Einstein equation. And it turns out that the Einstein equation is relating exactly these two. You know, remember, the intuition was that if the inflaton field fluctuates, so does the energy momentum tensor. And that impacts the metric. And you can also read the equations from left to right. You can say that if the metric is fluctuating, in particular, if this part is fluctuating, it will impact what the inflaton field does. And it turned out that this is a quantity that is gauge invariant. So this is the perturbation, the spatial perturbation of the inflaton field. This is part of the perturbations of the metric tensor. And that's just some prefactor that we can calculate from the underlying FRW space-time, because this is just a naught, you know, that's just this zero mode of the scale factor. It's just the ordinary scale factor. And that's just the zero mode of the inflaton field that we treat classically. All of these things we assume known, right? We know on what model this is all happening. We know which slow roll inflation it's happening. We assume that we have already calculated and solved the equations of motion for the scale factor and for the inflaton field's scalar zero mode. So all of these functions go into here. So they are known. And then we have that the inflaton field and this scalar part of the metric combine in this way to give us a new function, a new field, which is also called the Mukhanov variable. And that thing is what is really observable. Or that thing is what is really fluctuating. We will get into more detail about this in the next lecture. We just anticipate what we are dealing with here. In principle, we could say that this Mukhanov variable, this field, is entirely only that, and neglect this. We could also say that the Mukhanov variable doesn't have that, it has only this. How can we say the two things? How can both be true? Well, it depends on how you foliate your space-time. It turns out you can foliate your space-time, assuming that the fluctuations are small, first order. It turns out you can always foliate your space-time in such a way that equal time is equal value of phi. So phi might have fluctuations initially in whatever coordinate system you start out with. But now you change your coordinate system in such a way that equal time is equal value of phi. Right? So these are the perturbations. So this would be zero. And then as you travel along your space-like hypersurface of equal time, which is equal phi, you find that the metric is fluctuating. The metric is not always constant, not always the same. But there's an alternative canonical choice of coordinate system. You could choose a coordinate system such that equal time means equal value of psi in the metric. So then as you travel along one of those space-like hypersurfaces, you find that it is just completely flat as far as this is concerned. It might still be gravitational waves, but apart from that, it's completely flat. There is no curvature whatsoever, other than wild curvature there. This is completely absent. But if you travel along those space-like hypersurfaces where equal time is defined as equal psi value, namely psi equals zero value, then you find that the inflaton field is varying. So we arrive at a curious situation. The Einstein equation is coupling the inflaton field fluctuations to the metric fluctuations. And because you have this gauge freedom of choosing equal time hypersurfaces, of slicing space-time up into space-like hypersurfaces of equal time, and because you have that freedom to choose what you call equal time, you can choose a perspective, you can choose a coordinate system in which all of the fluctuations are due to curvature fluctuations. And you can choose another coordinate system in which all of the fluctuations are instead due to fluctuations of the inflaton field. And in principle, there's no preferred choice between them. And if you just choose some generic coordinate system, then you will have a mix of both contributing to this. And for some calculations, it may be convenient to choose a coordinate system such that only one or only the other contribute to the calculations. So what we will need to do, just previewing what comes next, we will need to develop the quantum field theory of this. You will need to calculate the quantum fluctuations of that. You will need to find out what equation does it obey. Does it obey the usual Klein-Gordon equation, this thing? Remember that comes from this obeys the Einstein equation. That obeys the Klein-Gordon equation. But the linearized Einstein equations are like Klein-Gordon equations. So let's see, what kind of equation does this obey? It will turn out that it obeys something like a Klein-Gordon equation with minor modifications. So we can use our machinery to quantize this and calculate its quantum fluctuation. And it is thought that it is the quantum fluctuations of this field that generated the temperature fluctuations in the CMB. It's not just plainly the inflaton field. Except if you choose your space-like hypersurfaces such that these guys are zero. So in a special gauge, you could argue that. But even then, you have these prefactors here. And we will need to quantize the Hij, the gravitational waves as well. So these guys, right? So we will find that after we use diffeomorphism invariance, we have these degrees of freedom and the Mukhanov variable, right? The variable R, which is a combination of both the fluctuations of the metric and the fluctuations of the inflaton field. It's the inhomogeneous part of the Einstein equation, and that's the homogeneous part of the Einstein equation. So we will quantize also these, the gravitational waves. And it will turn out that the R field, the Mukhanov variables, will be responsible for the temperature fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background. And these will be responsible for something else in the cosmic microwave background. Does anybody know yet what this is thought to be responsible for?
Polarization.
Yes. Do you know which one? The polarization of the cosmic microwave background can be decomposed into two components, just like the electric field, into a gradient part and into a curl part. You can think of the polarization as like a vector field in the sky. It's not exactly a vector field because polarization doesn't have a head on its vector, right? Because it's just a line polarization. I mean, this is the same polarization as that, right? But it is, roughly speaking, it's a vector field in the sky. And you can decompose it into its curl and to its gradient part. And it turns out that the gradient part has a different origin. But the curl part is mostly this, but only mostly. It turns out that some of the gradient part, of which there is way more, some of the gradient part can be turned into curl part by dust. And you may have heard of this famous experiment, the Bicep 2 experiment, where they announced a little prematurely that they had found the polarization fluctuations caused by Hij. That would have been fantastic. But it turns out that, well, they may have been right, they may have been wrong, but they can't claim that they have been right. Because there's a fair chance that what they saw was just contamination from dust in the galaxy, which has turned simple gradient type fluctuations into curve type fluctuations. So at the moment, the fluctuations caused by R are being measured with great accuracy. And these guys, I mean, if they get measured, that would be fantastic. Because as we will see, the fluctuation spectrum of R is non-trivially predicted to be related to the fluctuation spectrum of H, basically because both are driven by the same overall evolution. So the more precisely we measure the fluctuation spectrum of R, the more precisely we measure the temperature spectrum, the more accurately, in principle, we are predicting something about the spectrum of the gravitational waves. And therefore, in principle, we will arrive at something that can be used to either confirm or rule out inflation, because inflation makes certain predictions about the relationship between the two. That's the kind of thing that we will do in the next hours.